Hey, this is Brad. We're off today, but please enjoy this encore presentation of the Bradcast.
There were people over in New Jersey that were watching it, a heavy Arab population that were cheering as the buildings came down.
No, actually, that's not true.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is your Bradcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in L.A. In Oregon, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and now on 106.7 KSOW, KSO, in Cozy Cottage Grove, 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, and, of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling, action-packed adventure. We've got a lot ahead on today's show. First, some business. As I mentioned in the opening there, the Bradcast is now on KSOW, KSO, as they call it. 106.7 FM in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Delighted to be up there. Just wanted to give them an official howdy welcome. Cottage Grove is a small city in sort of south and central Oregon. And I was actually looking it up. Several films have been filmed in Cottage Grove, including the great Buster Keaton's. I'm a huge Buster Keaton fan. Great Buster Keaton's The General in 1926, and the movie's spectacular train crash, locomotive crash, and the wrecked train that was left over from that became actually, I'm told, a minor tourist attraction for some years, until that locomotive was scrapped during World War II for use in the war effort. Also, parts of 1978's Animal House and its climactic parade sequence was filmed in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and portions of the film Stand By Me were filmed along the railroad tracks east of Cottage Grove. So, very cool. We're delighted to be up there. My thanks to Donnie Sevilla and the good folks of Queso for welcoming us, welcoming the Bradcast. And, by the way, the Green News Report is also now on 106.7 FM, Desi
awesome.
Doyen.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. That's Desi Doyen, of course, my co-host on the Green News Report and our producer here. As long as we're doing just a little bit of business here at the top, I would just want to give a quick shout out and a quick thanks to those of you who have helped us of late, especially as we're heading into Black Friday and the holiday season. Thanks to our listeners who have helped us out, stopping by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on the air without any corporate or foundational political parties telling us what we can and can't say. We are completely independent on this program. As you may have noticed, if you've heard us before, we can say whatever the hell we like. And that is thanks to you folks for stopping by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue doing that. All right, coming up on today's Bradcast, following the November 13 terror attacks in Paris, there has been a lot of folks turning sort of cartwheels to try and misinterpret the attacks for their own political purposes. And we've spent quite a bit of time over the past week since those attacks discussing the nonsense regarding Syrian refugees and the political opportunists who are trying to bamboozle the public and profit from their from the public's xenophobic and too often racist tendencies to block Syrian refugees who are coming here or trying to come here in the wake of the attack. Never mind that none of the so far identified attackers were either Syrian nor refugees, And that France itself, and I haven't underscored this enough, France itself, who, by the way, we always make fun of, you know, for surrendering all the time, they still intend to allow 30,000 Syrian refugees to seek safe harbor in that country. And that country is much smaller than the U.S. And we've only committed to taking in 10,000. That is, if Congress doesn't stop us from taking any entirely, as they are attempting to do, as we talked about late last week. But in any way, in any event, the misguided fight over refugees is not the only such opportunism that is going on in the wake of those attacks. Intelligence officials, U.S. intelligence officials, despite evidence to support their lack of evidence to support their case, they are using the attacks to try and block the use of encryption technology by the citizenry, by, yes, you and me on our cell phones and on our computers. Some of these guys, some of these intelligence officials here in the U.S. are even using the Paris attacks as an opportunity to attack Edward Snowden again, somehow, amazingly enough. So anyway, we're going to talk to Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation about all of the above this hour, and just what these opportunists are trying to do now. Just how are they trying to pull the wool over your eyes now? We'll discuss all that with Trevor Tim. Haven't had him on the show in a couple years. Looking forward to that. Also, if time allows, as we hinted in the our opening quote there, the latest mass delusions, hallucinations, I think, of Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson and, yes, probably your crazy uncle at this coming Thanksgiving holiday dinner and mine. We will talk about Trump's imaginary 9/11 fantasy, if I have the time, and how that reminds us all of how, frankly, screwed up we are in this country right now. Speaking of screwed up in this country, there was an election in Louisiana over the weekend. Democrat, according to the Associated Press, Democrat John Bel Edwards won the runoff election for Louisiana governor on Saturday, defeating Republican Senator David Vitter and handing the Democrats their first statewide victory in Louisiana since 2008. Edwards is a state lawmaker. He will take over the office from term-limited Republican Governor Bobby Jindal, Republican governor and, I should add, failed presidential candidate Bobby Jindal. He'll take over in January from him. Voters' rejection of Vitter, says AP, was a stunning turn of events for the U.S. senator, who has been a political powerhouse in the state for years. He started this campaign nearly 2 years ago as the front runner, but John Bel Edwards offered a rare pickup of a gubernatorial seat for Democrats in the conservative Deep South. After his loss, Vitter immediately announced that he wouldn't seek re-election to the U.S. Senate next year either, creating a new competition for what had been a safe Republican seat. So very bad news for Republicans this weekend in the South. But wait, Brad, weren't you just talking about the fact just 1 week ago that when Republicans won a gubernatorial election in Kentucky, that we should be concerned about the results from that election? Well, yes, we should be. And if you'd like to be concerned about the results in Louisiana, you can be as well. I'll talk about that in a moment. Back to AP. In the final days, Vitter sought to rally Republicans by drawing policy distinctions with Edwards and making Syrian refugee resettlement an issue in the state campaign, but it didn't work, at least according to the 100% unverifiable election results from the state of Louisiana. That's right, the entire state, 100% unverifiable. More on that in a moment. Democrats were ecstatic as Edwards defied expectations that only a Republican could win statewide in Louisiana. He thanked his supporters who, quote, believed we could confound the conventional wisdom that this victory just couldn't happen. It did happen, Edwards said. This became a referendum on Vitter. And his past history, his 2007 prostitution scandal, in which he apologized for a, quote, serious sin after he was linked through phone records to the Washington D.C.'s D.C. madam. Instead of a referendum on the terrible, terrible financial problems that Republican Governor Bobby Jindal has left for the state of Louisiana, it became all about this prostitution scandal. So once again, we've got an absolute mess, an absolute economic mess that Republicans have left down there in Louisiana for the Democrat to have to now come in and clean up. Good luck to you, Mr. Edwards. Amazing. So Vitter was also hampered by high disapproval ratings for Jindal, who is blamed for those state financial problems. $30 million was spent on this race. $30 million. When the final campaign reports are filed, the contest is expected to be the most expensive governor's race in Louisiana history. But, Brad, what about the fact that you just claimed that they didn't verify the results in Kentucky, so we can't trust them in Kentucky? And in that case, a Republican won, but in Louisiana, a Democrat won. You're fine with that. Well, guess what? No, I am not fine with that. I am not fine with that. And if any Republican in Louisiana would like to challenge the results, that's fine by me. Now, there's a couple of distinctions between Kentucky and Louisiana. In Kentucky, the Democrat was winning by about 5 points heading into Election Day. He ended up losing in a landslide to the Republican by 9 points. So that's almost a 15-point swing, according to the election results, the computerized results, the results that are reported by the computer op scans that count most of the ballots in the state of Kentucky. They've got a lot of paper ballots, hand-marked paper ballots. That's good. So we can verify those in Kentucky. But in Kentucky, as in most states, they don't bother to verify them. They run them through the computer. These computer op scanners, which are often just wrong, which often fail, which can be easily manipulated, which can be hacked by outsiders, which can be easily manipulated by insiders. And they don't bother in Kentucky to verify that even one of those paper ballots was properly counted by the computers. Meanwhile, down in Louisiana, where we just had this election, the Democrat going into Election Day was actually up by 20 points, according to all of the different pre-election polls, the independent pre-election polls. So the Democrat was up by 20 points, much as he was in Connecticut, up by 5 points. Not Connecticut, Kentucky, up by 5 points. And then he ended up losing in Kentucky. But here, the Democrat ended up being reported as the winner. Now, if you have any questions about those results, and you very well may, if you have any questions about those results, if you would like to find out if, in fact, John Bel Edwards really won, if you are a Republican, and if you have concerns about the results, well, you're completely out of luck, because the entire state of Louisiana, except for mail-in, you know, absentee votes, other than that, the entire state of Louisiana votes on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems that, if this had been a question, if the Democrat had ended up losing even after being ahead 20 points, there would be absolutely nothing that Democrats could do in that state, much as there is absolutely nothing that Republicans can now do if they have concerns about those results. And if they do, that's fine by me. I think citizens ought to be able to oversee their own elections, Democratic, Republican, Independent, Green, Libertarian, I don't care. Citizens ought to be able to oversee their own elections. In Louisiana, they can't. In Louisiana, the people who run that state hate their voters so much, they have so little respect for their own voters, that they have instituted an electoral system that, even if they have a question, even if a voter has a question about the results, there's damn near nothing they can do about it. Now, there are certain things. There are audit logs, internal audit logs that can be examined. Good luck getting access to those. It would take months. You'd have to get permission from the state, from the proprietary makers of the voting machines. And even then, if you were able to find experts and spend the money to look at those audit logs, you might find something funny or strange. But you would never, never be able to go back and make sure that the results as reported actually reflect the intent of the voters. It is absolutely shameful what they do to voters in Louisiana. Louisiana, of course, is not alone in that. And there was more, let's call it, good news for Democrats in the Deep South over the weekend when it comes to elections, this time in Mississippi. And this is just amazing. According to the New York Times, luck smiled on a Democratic state representative, Blaine Eaton II, who had been forced by state law to draw straws for his seat after his race for re-election ended in a tie. On Friday afternoon, in a short, strange ceremony, as reported by the Times, the ceremony was presided over by Governor Phil Bryant, Republican Governor Phil Bryant, and Secretary of State Delbert Hoseman. Mr. Eaton and his Republican challenger, Mark Tulos, each removed a silver box from a bag. Mr. Eaton opened his box to reveal a long green straw, and with that, a mathematically improbable tie for the House District 79 seat, with each candidate having received exactly 4,589 votes. That tie had been broken, and the Democrat was announced the winner of that election, of that otherwise tied election, of that election that was otherwise reported to be a tie. Was it actually a tie? Once again, we have no idea, and we can't have any idea, because in Mississippi, at least in Smith County in this case, Smith County, Mississippi, they have so little respect for their voters. They hate their voters so much. They force their voters, once again, to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting machines. The very same type of touchscreen voting machines, by the way, that, boy, at least 10 years ago, I think, at this point or so, we showed at bradblog.com could be easily hacked in about 60 seconds or less. That's by an outsider. Insiders, they can just flip the race with a matter of keystrokes. No problem. But that was down in Smith County, Mississippi. Now, the Republican in this case has filed with the state House of Representatives. He's filed a challenge. Mr. Tulos, he is a lawyer himself. He declined to comment, but he said he planned to challenge if he lost the draw. And he lost that draw after that tie. He cited concerns about the way a county election board handled 9 paper affidavit ballots. Those are like provisional ballots. When voters in this case, where their names were erroneously left off of the voter rolls, they claim they were erroneously left off or removed. So they file an affidavit ballot. So they are challenging those. So this could all still change. But it's interesting that the only thing they could challenge are these 9 ballots that happen to be on paper. The other, about 10,000 votes? No idea if those were recorded right or not. So they're focusing on these 9 votes. And by the way, the Democrat, they could look at these 9 votes. They could find that the Democrat actually lost. And that's that. And if that happens, because you can't challenge any further, can't challenge those electronic machines any further, really. If that happens, that will give Mississippi Republicans a 3/5 supermajority in the state House of Representatives. That's right. This one single election here that ended up in a tie, that one person out there who did not cast their vote could have made the difference one way or another between the Democrat and the Republican, and a 3/5 supermajority in the state House of Representatives. That threshold, that 3/5 supermajority, is required to pass revenue-related bills in the state of Mississippi, and so, therefore, at stake was hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue. That 3/5 requirement has allowed the Democratic minority in the state legislature there to block Republican tax cut proposals in the past on the grounds that Mississippi needs that revenue to finance schools and other services. Says the New York Times, Republicans, who also control the state Senate and the governor's mansion, say that the cuts that they're trying to make include a proposal to phase out the state's corporate franchise tax and are needed to jumpstart the economy and promote job growth. Yes, the way they jumpstarted the economy and promoted job growth in Louisiana under Bobby Jindal. Or not. Anyway, so yeah, one vote makes a difference, and the ability to oversight all of it makes all of the difference. And there will never be any way to do that at this time in Mississippi, where, like Louisiana, they hate their voters and won't allow them to oversee their own elections. All right. Yeah, we got a lot more on today's show, so I better get to it. Better get to our quick break and then to Trevor Tim. I want to make sure we have time left over for Donald Trump's fertile imagination. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned. Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. We'll be back soon.
Don't talk about the weather.
Shh. It's a military secret.
Just keep your wits together.
Shh. That's the safest way to keep it.
These are critical times. Be careful of espionage.
Yes, be careful.
In such critical times, you've got to watch out for sabotage.
Oh, you do. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. We've talked a lot since the November 13 attacks in Paris. We've talked a lot since then about really all of the wrong messages being taken from it, at least, you know, when it comes to, for example, Syrian refugees and the way that so many, mostly on the right, but not entirely on the right, a whole bunch of Democrats also voted last week to prevent Syrian refugees from coming into the U.S., despite the fact that the attackers in Paris were neither Syrian nor refugees. So just completely wrong lesson learned. But you know what? That seems to be what we do in this country. But that is not the only wrong lesson, it seems, that has been taken from the Paris attacks. As Trevor Tim wrote in The Guardian late last week, the aftermath of the Paris terrorist attacks has now devolved into a dark and dishonest debate about how we should respond. Let's ban encryption, even though there's no evidence that the terrorists used it to carry out their crime, and let's ban Syrian refugees, even though the attackers were neither. It's hard to overstate how disgusting it has been to watch, writes Trevor Tim, as proven false rumors continue to be the basis for the entire political response, and technology ignorance and full-on xenophobia now dominate the discussion. That technical ignorance, I think, and the remarks refer to his remarks about banning encryption. We heard a lot about that in the hours following the attacks. And since then, I think that, you know, just this crazy hysteria about, you know, keeping Syrian refugees out of the U.S. as some sort of response to the Paris attacks. That's sucked up much of the oxygen in the room. But the question of encryption is out there, and it was carried on by a lot of, let's say, highly respected officials, former CIA directors and such. But what do they mean? What are the concerns about encryption? And frankly, I know for a lot of you listeners, you may be asking yourself, well, what the hell is encryption? Here to talk about all of the above is Trevor Tim. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He is a journalist, activist, lawyer. He writes a column for the UK's Guardian on privacy, free speech, and national security. He has contributed to The Atlantic, Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy, Harvard Law and Policy Review, and Politico, but we won't hold that against him. Trevor also formerly worked as an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Trevor Tim, it's been a couple of years since we've had you on the Bradcast, so welcome back, my friend.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. It has been too long. We will try to correct that in the future. So what exactly, let's sort of start with the basics here. Can you explain, so that even laymen can understand, what exactly are encrypted communications? And then we can get into the, you know, where they're good, where they're not good, and what the concerns are. But what exactly, what does encrypted communications even mean?
Sure. So, you know, pretty much everybody who uses the internet these days uses some form of encryption, whether they know it or not. So, for example, when you log on to your banking website, you see a little lock up in the upper left corner.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the connection is HTTPS encrypted. And this protects you from governments from spying on your password, from hackers or criminals, getting into your financial information. And it's really the bedrock of e-commerce. So, you know, virtually any shopping you do online, you have to log in to an encrypted version of a mm-hmm. website, whether it's on eBay or Amazon or Google or whatever. You are using encryption. The thing with encrypted communications in the past year has been that it has kind of expanded into our text messages and phone calls. So, for example, if you have an iPhone and you use iMessage or FaceTime,
mm-hmm.
Those are what we call end-to-end encrypted. And so that means that only the person that you're talking to and yourself can access the conversation that you're having and see the words that are being communicated. Anybody else would just see a jumbled mass of just scrambled letters.
So if somebody was able to tap the communications going back and forth in these conversations, in these text messages and so forth, all they would see is some crazy code that makes no sense. They wouldn't see the actual text that was being sent back and forth unless they had the key to decrypt that encrypted text, correct?
Exactly. And the key here is that, for example, with Apple, even Apple does not hold the key, because what Apple has decided and what a bunch of other tech companies have decided is that they do not want to store a vast trove of every single person's communications
mm-hmm.
on a giant server and have one key that unlocks everything. Because as we've seen over the past year with data breach after data breach, whether it's Target, whether it's JP Morgan Chase, or whether it's the federal government,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's the Ashley Madison hack, when you have large troves of information that aren't encrypted and that somebody can access all at once, it is very almost certain that some sort of hacker or foreign government or criminal or even our own government will try to attack that information, steal it, and then potentially use it for their financial gain. So this encryption is set up to protect the millions of innocent citizens
mm-hmm.
Around the world that, you know, try to communicate online privately or try to, do banking or shopping online. And what is happening in this debate is that the government is vilifying this, the thing that actually makes us more secure. And they would like to actually lessen our security and make this type of encryption illegal.
Now, is it how difficult is it for a hacker when we hear about these hacks? Are these matters of the hackers have figured out the encryption key, or have they stolen the encryption key, or are we talking about things that aren't encrypted in the first place and we only discover that they're vulnerable after the hack has happened?
You know, it's a little bit of both. For some of the hacks, its information wasn't encrypted at all to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember the Office of the OPM hack, which was the government agency that held all of the security clearance reviews that they were doing for everybody in the federal government who
mm-hmm.
was applying for security clearance, that information wasn't encrypted at all. But in other cases, if you have a giant trove of information and you encrypt it, you know, it's millions of people's of information, but you encrypt it with one key,
mm-hmm.
those hackers will go and find that key and steal that key. And so what Apple has done is it has made it impossible for anybody to do that, because everybody essentially holds their own key on their phone. And so, if a hacker can potentially get into your phone,
mm-hmm.
They could see your messages, but they wouldn't be able to see the millions of other people's messages all at once. It's basically the ultimate security feature to protect our information in the long term. And we're going to see more and more companies moving to this model because it's really the only way to keep large quantities of information secure from all these hackers. And unfortunately, what the government is saying is, on the one hand, you know, cybersecurity is the number one priority, and on the other, let's take the best weapon we have to protect this information, and make it illegal.
Are they against encryption per se, or are they saying encryption is fine, just make sure we have a key if we need it, if we as law enforcement or intelligence agencies give us the keys, you can trust us?
Right, that's exactly what they're saying, which is, you can use encryption as long as you give us the key. That's the law that they would like to pass. Unfortunately, security doesn't work that way. I mean, put aside the fact that, if this was ever a power given to government, they would inevitably abuse it, because as we've seen over and over again in history, they constantly abuse their surveillance powers. But even let's just say that we trust the government 100% and that they will never abuse the power of having a key, and that they will only use it when they have a warrant for information. The problem with that is that key is still vulnerable to all of these other actors who will try to steal it. So all sorts of criminals, all sorts of foreign governments like the Russians, the Chinese, anybody who has a hacking unit, like all of these governments do these days, they will try to steal that key from the U.S. government, which, as we've seen, is not that hard to do, given that the entire U.S. government, it seems, has been hacked over the past couple of years by various forms of government.
I got you.
Whether we're talking about State Department emails that were hacked by allegedly the Russian government, whether it was all of the 20 million people who had applied for security clearances, whether it's the White House email system, all these things we found out over the past year have been hacked and infiltrated by all of these third parties. And we're going to say, oh, yeah, we trust you with the one key that will unlock every single person's communications. That, to me, sounds like a crazy idea.
And given the fact that the U.S. government, at least as I understand, has most likely been able to crack and hack and infiltrate all of these other countries, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, and so on and so forth, doesn't the U.S. government understand that it is possible to do this, that it's possible to hack in and steal this stuff? Therefore, shouldn't they also be concerned, about foreign countries doing it to us? Don't they know that it is possible?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great point. You know, there's an amazing story that was based on the Snowden documents that was published in The Intercept by longtime NSA reporter James Bamford. And it talks about actually how this is a tried and true technique of the NSA, where they find what they call a lawful intercept system in other countries, which is basically a backdoor that other governments have to their phone systems. And they find that backdoor, and this happened at the Greece Olympics in 2006. The Greece government has a way of tapping phone calls if they have proper legal authority. Well, the NSA allegedly found this backdoor and started spying on Greece politicians, journalists, all sorts of people inside Greece that had nothing to do with terrorism. But because they found this vulnerability and this key, that they were able to spy, with no sort of legal restrictions required. And they did this in country after country, as James Bamford kind of lays out and shows in the Snowden documents. So certainly some people in the U.S. government know it was a problem. Unfortunately, there is a lot of technical illiteracy in Congress especially, and so they might not understand all of the intricacies of how this works, and they think, oh, well, why don't you just give the government a magic key and everything will be okay, when that's, in fact, not true
at all. You know, and I could understand that from members of Congress not really understanding or not wanting to understand the science involved here, although it seems like they could, call Trevor Tim and just ask him to explain this stuff, and it makes perfect sense. But when I see guys like a former CIA official, a CIA director, James Woolsey, I'm going to play one of his audio pieces in a moment, but when I see them, making this argument, I just have to... I was going to say I have to scratch my head and wonder what they're thinking, but maybe we can guess what they're thinking. I don't know. Listen, after the Paris attacks, on November 13, because we've had a number of them. We had the Charlie Hebdo in January and this thwarted train attack, I think, in July. After that attack, you had a number of these intelligence officials, mostly former like Woolsey, but I think even perhaps some current ones, come out, you know, to the media and tell the media that it was encrypted in communication that is being used by groups like ISIS, and that that is the problem. They even blamed, incredibly, Edward Snowden somehow for those November 13th attacks. And I'll play that in a moment. But Glenn Greenwald wrote at The Intercept recently, quote, credible news sites are regurgitating the claim that the Paris terrorists were enabled by Snowden leaks based on no evidence or specific proof of any kind. Needless to say, but just the unverified, obviously self-serving assertion of government officials is all that was needed. Much of the U.S. media love to repeat rather than scrutinize what government officials tell them to say. So now this accusation has become widespread. I also saw that, Trevor, Tim, for example, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. She did a whole piece right after the Paris attacks about this program called Telegram, on how ISIS was asking people to contact them with Telegram, and that it made it possible for intelligence officials and made it impossible for intelligence officials to follow the planning being done by ISIS. How much of that is true as far as how much are they using encrypted technology, and how much does that cripple our intelligence services from being able to, you know, to know about attacks like the Paris attacks in advance?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. However, you know, unfortunately, in the days following the Paris attacks, it was just we were given all of this misinformation and oversimplification about encryption. And, you know, the government agencies, by the way, which have hundreds of billions of dollars of funding, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, these extraordinary powers that we've given them over the past 15 years, you know, with almost zero oversight, are complaining that a couple little encryption programs are making the entire internet go dark, which is frankly just not true, and outrageous that they kind of got away with saying all this stuff without a hint of pushback. So the facts are that it is entirely possible that some terrorists use some encryption programs, because billions of people use encryption programs every day. However, the government has plenty of ways to spy on them without resorting to passing a law banning encryption. So, for example, they can still get cell phone location information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for where exactly these people are. They can get all of the metadata, which is the who called who, where they're calling from, for how long and how often. They can hack into their phones and their computers. You know, all the encryption in the world is not going to stop the government from reading text messages if they can hack into people's phones, which they do all the time. And, you know, the idea that a couple encrypted apps are letting these terrorists go completely dark, we know just isn't true. And we can actually go back and look at all of the facts that we know about the Paris attacks themselves. So as the government was kind of, you know, screaming from the hilltops about encryption, they were quietly admitting that they didn't have any evidence that these particular terrorists were actually using encryption at all. We found out in the days after the attack that, in fact, that 7 of the 8 known attackers were already known to U.S. and or French intelligence authorities before the attack. We know that they used Facebook to communicate, which law enforcement has long had access to Facebook if they serve them a proper warrant. We learned that they were using unencrypted SMS text messaging, which is about the easiest thing in the world for them to wiretap. We even learned that the ringleader was bragged in ISIS's English language magazine in February that he was in Europe and was planning an attack. There was a full glossy photo of him in this English language magazine. So there was plenty of intelligence for the intelligence agencies to find these guys and stop them, yet they fell through the cracks. And instead of concentrating on you know, the intelligence agency's failures and whether they actually have too much information, let alone not enough, they were able to blame encryption for all of this as kind of this shiny scapegoat that let them get off scot-free. And unfortunately, now that the facts have come in, the damage has already been done, and there's this picture in everybody's mind that encryption is actually the problem. when it's nowhere close to that, and it is actually, for a lot of our security needs, a solution.
It seems like
it's been vilified in the media.
Yeah, it does seem like these officials, and it always seems to be these high-ranking intelligence officials, sometimes by name, sometimes unnamed. After these attacks, it looks like they are trying to find someone or something other than themselves. As I mentioned, you know, the attackers in the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January, they were known. The attackers the thwarted train attack in France were known in advance. Same true with the November 13 attacks. It seems like they're always trying to find someone or something else to blame in these cases, despite, you know, the just amazing access they have, particularly when we're talking about overseas now. You know, there has theoretically, I underscore, been some rollback of the access to American phone records. But overseas, it's, you know, the U.S. can do any damn thing they want. You would think they would, for all of the tapping and everything else they are doing, you would think they would have some information in these attacks before they happen. And yet, it seems like they never do, that metadata never actually results in a terrorist attack that has been stopped. Are you familiar? And I do want to get to this Woolsey audio in a second, but are you familiar, Trevor, Tim, with any case where tracking that metadata that has been so controversial in the U.S., where that has stopped a terror attack, prevented an attack here in the U.S. or abroad?
Yeah, I mean, that's the really dishonest thing here is that, like, for example, CIA Director John Brennan came out and said, basically blamed privacy advocates for this terrorist attack, saying that the hand-wringing policies post-Snowden and the legal challenges and the change in law has really tied the hands of the intelligence agencies, which, first of all, he's lying. Number one, that the only program that the USA Freedom Act, which Congress passed a few months ago, actually affected was this mass phone surveillance program that only happens in the U.S. That program is actually still running. It's not supposed to be shut down until the end of the month.
Okay.
So it's been running this whole time. And for them to kind of blame this law that only affects this one program that doesn't affect any of their collection of intelligence overseas is the height of dishonesty. And, you know, the idea that they don't have enough information to collect is actually the opposite of the problem. As we've seen time and time again, often when these terrorist attacks happen, these people are already known to intelligence agencies or there's some obvious clue that should have alerted intelligence agencies to watch them closer. But unfortunately, while they're trying to catch terrorists, they're also collecting information on hundreds of millions of innocent people at the same time and actually drowning in information. And so all of these obvious clues, because they're not focusing on just the people they should be focusing on, instead they're focusing on the entire population, are kind of being left in the dust. And we have a situation like the Paris attacks where, you know, there's obvious things like I just saw on Twitter here that, you know, one of the attackers on their Facebook profile had publicly posted a picture of an AK-47, days before the attack went down. So, it's unfortunate. You know, nobody's arguing that we shouldn't be surveilling terrorists under proper court supervision. It's the surveillance of hundreds of millions of innocent people that is both unconstitutional and just ineffective.
Both taking away rights and creating a needle in a haystack situation. All right, let me very quick. We've got just a minute or two left here. We're speaking with Trevor Tim of the Freedom of the Press Foundation and a columnist at the UK's Guardian. Trevor, I want to get your thoughts on this clip from James Woolsey, a former CIA director, I think, under Bill Clinton. Was he not, Trevor?
Yep.
Under Bill Clinton. This is just an amazing clip to me on at least two different scores. Let me play this 30 seconds, and then I'll get your take on both of these points, because This is just amazing to me. James Woolsey on CNN just last week, I think, in the wake of the Paris terror attacks.
I said that I thought he ought to be brought back to the United States and tried before a jury of his peers if convicted of treason, which is, I think, the appropriate charge.
Didn't you say you thought he had?
Well, it was still it's still a capital crime, and I would give him the death sentence, and I would prefer to see him hanged by the neck until he was dead rather than merely electrocuted.
Now, he's talking about Edward Snowden there, by the way. And I should have made that clear at the top. He's talking about Edward Snowden. He's not talking about one of the terrorists of the attacks. He's talking about Edward Snowden being hanged by the neck until he was dead. And then he went on to say,
I think the blood of a lot of these French young people is on his hands.
Because of what he revealed.
Because of what he turned loose.
Wow. Wow. Hang Edward Snowden by the neck until he is dead, Trevor Tim, and blood is on his hands in France because of what he set loose. Can you even begin to explain to me what he actually means there, and then how he's just, and whether he's right or wrong?
I mean, it is honestly disgusting. Not only disgusting that James Woolsey was led on CNN to discuss his fantasies about killing Snowden and the different ways that he would go about it. But the CNN anchors, time and time again, provide absolutely no pushback against this.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that terrorists suddenly discovered that the U.S. government was surveilling them after Edward Snowden, or that they had never heard of encryption before the Edward Snowden attacks, is ludicrous. I mean, we have article after article from every major newspaper going back to the mid-90s talking about how terrorists use sophisticated levels of encryption and are fully aware the U.S. government is trying to surveil them. And this is, again, just a scapegoat that former and current intelligence officials are using to, hide and cover up their own failures. And when they're out there blaming Snowden, no one is asking them questions about what they could have done better mm-hmm. or where they failed. To be honest, it was a pretty masterful PR tactic by them. And unfortunately, the media took it hook, line, and sinker, and especially on television. Print media eventually figured it out and started writing, kind of the truth along with rebuttals to actually what was going on. But, on CNN, it's just like that 24 hours a day, and they've continued to have on intelligence officials kind of spewing this garbage. With no pushback.
It's
shameful.
It really is. And I'd expect that sort of thing, hang him by the neck until he was dead. Edward Snowden has blood on his hands after Paris. I'd expect that from the bowels of, far right wing Fox News. But this is not just CNN, but a former CIA director under Bill Clinton. It's just amazing. And no pushback from CNN, and all of this sort of disappears into the ether as we see all of the, the nonsense about Syrian refugees. So I wanted to bring out this concern, this so-called debate about encryption, because I think it is getting lost. And Trevor, greatly appreciate you bringing it to the forefront in your column at The Guardian. And you should check out Trevor's work. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which you can find on the internets at freedom.press. Do I have that right, that URL?
Yeah, that's right. We actually have they just started releasing these .press domains late last year, and so we were one of the first ones, freedom.press.
That's very cool. You can also spy all you like on Trevor Tim on the Twitters. He is Trevor Tim with two M's and also at Freedom of Press on Twitter. Trevor, great to talk to you, my friend, and hope we get to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was fun.
You bet. All right, a quick break, and we are back with more broadcast right after this. Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
All aboard!
Welcome back to the Bradcast and to the Crazy Train. Brother, over the weekend, what was Boy, you know, I hate even covering this stuff, but it's just, it's so amazing what's going on the Republican side of the aisle, the presidential race. It's just absolutely amazing. All right, to tell this story very quickly, let's go back just a few weeks. Carly Fiorina, at one of the Republican debates, I can't even remember which one this was, coming out and telling us that she saw in this video this absolutely horrible, horrific scene.
I dare Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama to watch these tapes, watch a fully formed fetus on the table, its heart beating, its legs kicking, while someone says we have to keep it alive to harvest its brain. This is about the character of our nation. And if we will not stand up and force President Obama to veto this bill, shame on us.
Wow, that does sound horrible. Of course, that was this video that was supposedly made showing these terrible things done at Planned Parenthood. The only problem is that there is apparently no such footage like what Carly Fiorina just described in that debate. And then she was asked about it. Where was this, Desi Doyen? She was asked on...
It was on Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace.
Oh, that's right. Chris Wallace, the liberal media, Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace, put it to her and said, yeah, nobody actually has ever seen that footage.
Do you acknowledge what every fact checker has found, that as horrific as that scene is, it was only described on the video by someone who claimed to have seen it. There is no actual footage of the incident that you just mentioned.
No, I don't accept that at all. I've seen the footage, and I find it amazing, actually, that all these supposed fact checkers in the mainstream media claim this doesn't exist. They're trying to attack the authenticity of the videotape. I will continue to dare anyone who wants to continue to fund Planned Parenthood, watch the videotape.
So she just doesn't accept the fact that nobody can find it. None of the fact checkers can find it, and her campaign was unable to bring it forward. They haven't been able to bring it forward to this day, and I think that was, that was several weeks ago, wasn't it?
That was back
September.
In September.
Yeah. But Fiorina is certain that she saw it. It doesn't matter that people tell her she didn't see it. It doesn't matter that nobody has been able to bring forward that footage. She knows she saw it, and she's going with it. Even though Fox News is calling her out on it, she's going with it. Fast forward to the weekend. Donald Trump at an event, by the way, where some of his supporters beat up a protester, punched and kicked the protester, which, of course, Donald Trump is not responsible for, you know. Every Muslim in the world is responsible for any terrorist attack that ever takes place carried out by a Muslim, according to Donald Trump. But he's not responsible when his own supporters beat the crap out of someone at an event. But never mind that. Here's what he had to say about 9/11 and what happened on 9/11 that he knows, that he remembers, that he personally saw.
I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down. And I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. Thousands of people were cheering.
Thousands of people, thousands and thousands, and Donald Trump watched. And of course, what he's trying to say is that these were supporters, sympathizers, Muslims who were happy to see the World Trade Center coming down. Donald Trump saw it. He watched it. He saw the footage. Everyone saw it. We all watched. There was thousands and thousands of people cheering, though. Funny thing, nobody can seem to find that footage. Not the Trump campaign, not any other. And Donald Trump was then called on it by ABC News, by George Stephanopoulos on ABC This Week.
You know, the police say that didn't happen, and all those rumors have been on the internet for some time. So did you misspeak yesterday?
It did happen. I saw it.
You saw that with your own eyes?
George, it didn't happen. There were people that were cheering in the other side of New Jersey, where you have large Arab populations. They were cheering as the World Trade Center came down. I know it might be not politically correct for you to talk about it, but there were people cheering as that building came down, as those buildings came down. And that tells you something. It was well covered at the time, George. Now, I know they don't like to talk about it, but it was well covered at the time. There were people over in New Jersey that were watching it, a heavy Arab population that were cheering as the buildings came down. Not good.
As I said, the police have said it didn't happen. What I want to move on right now, a chorus of rivals are pouncing the database comments.
It was heavily covered at the time. The media covered it a lot. And yet, no one can seem to come up with any footage showing thousands and thousands of people in New Jersey cheering the buildings coming down. Now, there was some footage, I think, of people in Palestine supposedly cheering this on. And yet, somehow, in Trump's mind, he is certain that he saw thousands and thousands in New Jersey celebrating as the towers were coming down, much as Carly Fiorina is certain that she saw this horrific abortion scene happening on a table in this Planned Parenthood video that no one else has seen. But they saw it. They were told they saw it. They're sticking with it, even though they've been called out on it, even though they've been asked to show us where that footage is. I think that Carly Fiorina actually thinks she saw this. I think Donald Trump actually thinks he saw it. Ben Carson was asked about this very same scene by ABC News, and here was Ben Carson's response.
Dr. Carson, were American Muslims in New Jersey cheering on 9/11 when the towers fell? Did you hear about that or see that?
Yes.
Yes. Can you expand on that?
You know, there are going to be people who respond inappropriately to virtually everything. I think that was an inappropriate response. I don't know if on the basis of that you can say all Muslims are bad people. I really think that would be a stretch.
Did you see that happening, though, on 9/11?
I saw the film of it, yeah.
In New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Carson, just...
In New Jersey. Yeah, he saw it. He saw it. We all saw it. Donald Trump saw it. Carly Fiorina saw that horrible abortion scene. They saw it. No, they didn't see it. They were told that's what happened. They were told that's what happened because they watch Fox News, and that's what Fox News tells them. Oh, people in New Jersey, thousands were cheering when the World Trade Center came down. No, they didn't. They didn't. There is no such footage. There is no such video. There was a horrible scene. Planned Parenthood is selling baby parts. No, they're not. But that's what Fox News told them, and that's what these people actually believe. I don't think Donald Trump is lying. I don't think Fiorina is lying. I don't think Ben Carson is lying. I think they saw this. And this is the delusional world that Republicans now live in. They see what they want to see, whether it exists or not. And there are many, many, many Americans who are joining them in this mass hallucination because they watch Fox News too, and they are told that this is what they saw, and they believe it. And this makes it incredibly difficult to run against these people or to argue with them at your Thanksgiving dinner table, because these are people who are deadly convinced of a completely alternate reality. Fiorina, I believe, thinks she saw it. Donald Trump, I believe, thinks he saw it. Ben Carson thinks he saw it because someone told them that they did. I believe that your crazy uncle and mine believe that Syrian refugees were behind the Paris attacks because Fox News told them so, and that Black Lives Matter protesters are actually out there killing police because that's what Fox News told them. This is what they've been told from their right-wing media sources, and everyone else who tells them otherwise is a liberal liar. So these hallucinations have replaced reality inside the Republican wingnut bubble, and now only superheroes like Donald Trump can fly in and save the world from this pretend reality that they themselves have created. And unfortunately, I must say, I see precious little on the horizon. I see nothing, in fact, that is going to shake these people from their paranoid, nonsensical, fantastical fever dreams. And that should be very troubling to every American and every citizen of the world. Unfortunately, nothing's going to shake them because there are just too many people making too much money from the ignorance of their audiences. And so it will continue. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to my guest today, Trevor Tim of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and of course to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of the show, stop by bradblog.com, where you can download it for free anytime, anywhere, and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. I'm Brad Friedman. Until we meet again, good luck, world. Everybody.